Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
With Labor Day less than 2 weeks away, here's a reality check on the cost of gas. We decided to crunch some numbers with the help of AAA using their online trip calculator. We found that if you drove an SUV from Boston to Washington, D.C. at today's gas prices, you'd pay about $160. That trip in a smaller economy car would cost about half that price. Well, with this in mind, news from the U.S. Transportation Department today, Secretary Norman Mineta announced that new fuel efficiency standards were arriving for pickups, minivans, and some SUVs. He says the plan will save 10 billion gallons of fuel in the first 3 years. Well, for more on the new standards and gas prices, we're joined by Vahan Janjigian. He's vice president of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. And Vahan, in your view, what do these new standards mean for car makers?
Thanks, Robin. Well, basically, it looks like the major difference is going to be how they actually calculate the numbers. Right now, light trucks are required to meet a standard across the entire fleet. What the Department of Transportation is proposing is that starting in 2008, they're going to create six categories for light trucks based on the size, and each category would have a different standard.
Well, and as we've reported here, some large SUVs, for instance, such as the Hummer H2, are not going to be affected by the plan. So do you think that overall this change is going to really affect energy savings?
Well, I don't think the change itself is going to affect energy savings as much as the price of gasoline is going to affect energy savings. I think consumers are going to respond to that because of the market forces, and as a result, they are voluntarily going to stop driving the gas guzzlers and switch to more efficient cars.
Right, and let's talk about that price of gas. We see it's risen 6 cents in the last week. That followed an 18-cent jump the week before. We're reading 73 cents per gallon a rise in the last year, according to the Energy Department. How high is it going to get?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, even if it gets to $3 a gallon, that's still significantly cheaper than what it is in Europe, for example. But I think it has reached a point now where it's starting to affect consumer behavior. I mean, we're starting to see consumers having trouble paying for gasoline. We're starting to see them shopping less at stores like Walmart, which recently reported disappointing earnings. So I think it's finally having an impact.
And remind us again, just tick off the reasons why it's so high.
Well, there's basically a couple of things going on. One major problem, however, is that most of the oil-producing countries are producing almost as much as they possibly can, so there isn't much slack in their production capabilities. And as a result, if something goes wrong, such as a terrorist strike in Saudi Arabia or political unrest in Venezuela or in Nigeria or something like that, we could end up with shortages. We've already seen recently some refinery fires that have affected the price of gasoline. So anything that disrupts the supply could really boost up the price, and I think it's the fear of this disruption that's causing the price to go up right now.
Right, we understand fear keeps speculators bidding up the gas prices. Well, you mentioned the impact on consumers. We're seeing the price of gas leading to another unbelievable problem, what's known as a drive-off, people driving away from the pump without paying. A tragic incident last week in Alabama where police say a service station owner was run over by the driver of an SUV who tried to get away without paying his, I think, $52 tab. The National Association of Convenience Stores says that last year gas theft cost retailers $237 million. Do you see more of this gas rage?
Well, yeah, I think as the price of gasoline goes up, the temptation to steal the gasoline, not to pay for it, also goes up. And you know, what can be done about this? I think the simple answer is for gas stations to require payment before you actually pump. Now, not everybody can afford to install new pumps that require that. And I've actually seen some gas stations recently having a person posted outside watching the consumers pump their gas and making sure they pay for it before they leave.
And Vahan Janjigian, just what's your speculation? Is the cost of gas going to continue to rise, or do you see a dip, as some predict?
Well, I'm actually expecting the price of crude oil to fall by the end of the year, but I think we're still going to have relatively high prices of crude oil, somewhere around maybe $50 a barrel, and that's still enough to cause a pinch in consumer pockets. We may see gasoline hit $3 per gallon before it finally drops a little bit, but I think we better get used to higher prices from here on out.
Vahan Janjigian, Vice President of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, many travelers will be looking to the skies for the upcoming Labor Day and wondering how a labor dispute might affect them. It's been 4 days since the 4,400 mechanics and janitors at Northwest Airlines went on strike. Some analysts are reporting delays for more than half of Northwest's flights. But so far, the airline is managing to keep most of its planes in the air. The strike marks the first time in 7 years that workers at a major airline have walked out. It's seen as both a test for Northwest and for big labor. So to bring us up to date, we're joined by Micheline Maynard. She's a reporter with the New York Times. She's covering the strike. Mickey, welcome.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
We're also joined by Tom Parsons. He's the CEO of bestfares.com. That's a consumer website. Tom, welcome to you as well.
Well, thank you.
But Mickey, I want to start with you. It is day four, as we said. How are things going? How is service on Northwest being affected?
For the most part, service on Northwest is running fairly smoothly. As you mentioned, there were a number of delays on Saturday and Sunday, the first couple of days of the strike, and Northwest is saying that it expects about 4% of its flights to be canceled through this week. Mm. Now, to put some context in that, normally about 2% of an airline's flights are canceled in any given month, and in fact, this summer has been one of the worst summers in the last few years for aviation delays, so you could run into a delay on cancellation on another airline that wasn't undergoing a labor disruption.
And by the way, why was it the worst summer? What were those delays about?
Well, I did a piece in the Times recently talking about the fact that this year we've had the most delays as far as departures are concerned ever in raw numbers, and it's the worst in 5 years in the number of arrival delays. And there are a bunch of factors going on. One is that there's a record demand for travel. We are back up to the loads of the year 2000, which was the biggest year for travel in the industry's history. Cheap fares are drawing people to the airlines, and they're actually putting up with the disruptions because, you know, if you can fly someplace for $89 and get there 10 minutes late versus paying $200 and getting there on time, they're willing to pay the $89.
And we're going to talk much more about that with Tom in just a second, but staying with the strike for a second, of course, we are in the middle of a labor dispute, so the unions are claiming that many more of the Northwest flights are being delayed than Northwest is saying. That's, you know, we're in, as I said, the middle of a dispute. But we know that Northwest prepared for about a year and a half for this strike. They had a not-so-secret plan to train replacements out on planes that were parked out in Arizona. We've reported on that. But how is it going? Who is maintaining the planes? Who's keeping them in the air and fixing and maintaining them?
Northwest is using about 1,900 people. There are 1,200 licensed mechanics that they've hired in. There's about 300 supervisory personnel and then another 400 contractors. Basically, the licensed mechanics have come from other airlines, not that they're working at the other airlines, but they were laid off. Since the year 2000, we've seen 130,000 people in the airline industry lose their jobs. And there are a lot of people that did go on to work as car mechanics and in other jobs. But, you know, if you were an airline mechanic, you want to work on the big planes. And so Northwest went out looking for replacement workers a few months ago, and people sent in their resumes. They hired people whose resumes were posted on the internet. I think there'll be a great story in all this on how the internet has played a role in this labor disruption. Mm. But they hired the replacement workers. They've been training them in the classroom. They've been practicing on the planes, as you've said. They've undergone sort of an orientation process as they got in here. But these are people who knew how to fix airplanes. They have 5 to 10 years of experience, and you know, a Boeing 737 is basically a Boeing 737, whether it's a Northwest plane or a Southwest plane. What are difference are the base are some of the maintenance procedures and the paperwork you fill out, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't as huge a task as it might have been had they just hired people who'd been, you know, working at Target or something.
Well,
like that.
Yes, that would be a problem. We're speaking about airplanes here.
It also probably wouldn't be legal either, right? Because these people have to have what's called an A and P license that you receive, and so they're all certified.
Right. Well, speaking of the internet, Tom Parsons with bestfares.com, how is this impacting consumers and people flying?
I'm not sure if we've seen any hiccups. I think this is just, I think the union picked the wrong season to to put their demands on Northwest and walk out, I mean, we're going into probably what we call the slowest season of the year. And therefore, there's going to be ample opportunities to it might be the best time for Northwest to face these problems, too, because, again, many people are going back to school, back to work. But therefore, the airfare deals are coming not because of Northwest, but because of the low-cost airlines. We're still seeing those coast-to-coast airfares of $198 round trip. I think it's more important, though, I think today that the traveling public look at alternate airports versus what we call non-competitive markets, because we are seeing increases of 10 times since February. But overall, I think if Northwest has the cheapest airfare and they're flying from point A and B and it saves the consumer $20, $30, or $100, I think they're going to choose that airline and fly it anyway.
Right, and we're going to talk more about, you know, it might also have been the best union for Northwest to pick for this dispute. We'll talk more about labor in a minute. But staying with the consumer now, here's perhaps a stupid question, Tom. Why are the airlines charging so little for tickets? Because it seems to be getting them into trouble, as we've just talked about, the rising gas prices. So the template seems to be low fares, but rising gas means they have to cut benefits and labor. So why that template? Why? I mean, we all know we have to pay for gas. Why aren't the tickets more?
Well, again, I think today we have about 30%, 35% of America can travel on routes served by a low-cost airline. The legacy airlines like American, United, Delta, Northwest, Continental, U.S. Airways, they're trying to slow down these low-cost airlines. They're trying to just put them at a halt. They're trying to keep them from expanding. That's a JetBlue, an AirTran, a Southwest, a Spirit, Frontier, a few of those guys out there. And they can also fly much cheaper. But we still see Southwest. They made over they're going to report several $100 million in profit. AirTran's probably going to report a profit this year. And it appears they're setting the pricing. And if they believe they can fly coast to coast for $190, as a matter of fact, on the East Coast right now, I mean, we look at Providence and Hartford and Buffalo and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Baltimore. You can fly down to Orlando, Tampa, Fort Myers, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach for $98 round trip through December. That's just dirt cheap, and I don't know how the legacy airlines do make money. I guess my answer to you is I don't care. It's cheap. I do believe we're going to see more bankruptcies. I mean, there's a good opportunity that Northwest now will enter into bankruptcy. I think Delta is teetering on bankruptcy. I think you're talking about the pensions out there. Northwest still owes probably in the next 2 years almost $2 billion. I think they're going to do, I think some of these legacy airlines are going to do what United and U.S. Airways has done and say, we're going to get not paid into the pension plan anymore and file bankruptcy to get rid of it.
That's Tom Parsons, CEO of bestfares.com. So he tells us what we've been hearing, Mickey, that it's all about labor because Southwest and JetBlue and other airlines have managed these low prices because of how they've dealt with unions and labor. Tom, thank you so much for your insight.
Okay, thank you.
And when we come back, we're going to talk more about how, you know, the labor pains of planes might be also affecting automobiles. We'll keep Mickey with us, and we'll be joined by another guest to continue looking at what's happening in the skies, how it's going to affect what might be happening to your car. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. The strike at Northwest enters its fourth day. We're talking about what the walkout might mean for workers at other airlines and in other industries, like Detroit, where automakers are hoping to cut labor costs as well. Mickey Maynard of the New York Times is still with us. She's covering the Northwest Airlines strike for the Times. In a previous life, she covered the auto industry, and she wrote a book called The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Mickey, welcome back.
Thank you.
We're also joined by David Gregory. He's a professor of labor law at St. John's University in New York. Professor, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Mickey, I want to pick up with you. We just heard Tom Parsons, who's with a consumer organization, say he just doesn't care about big labor issues when low-cost carriers like Southwest and JetBlue are giving him and his consumers lower prices. Is this just, you know, further evidence that the day of the legacy carriers is really over?
Well, the legacy carriers no longer set the pace for everyone else in the airline industry. It really is set by these low-fare carriers. And I just want to make one thing clear. While JetBlue is a non-union company, there are unions in place at Southwest Airlines. But the very structure of these labor contracts is different than in the old-style contracts. And in fact, that's what Northwest has done. Not only did they bring in replacement workers, but they basically changed the nature of the work. And they sort of went to bed as Northwest Airlines on Friday night and woke up as JetBlue on Saturday morning, at least as far as the way it uses its mechanics are concerned.
Tell us more about that. What's the difference? What's the difference in the structure?
Many, many differences. First of all, there are far fewer people. There are 2,000 fewer people. They've contracted out the heavy maintenance that they do on their big planes. In other words, these extensive checks where they take a 747 apart and put it back together again. The trend in the industry has been to send that work overseas, actually, to much cheaper sources. They've also eliminated all kinds of restrictions. People were telling me that there were only things that mechanics could do. For example, they were the only ones that could move the planes from the hangars. And the other day in Detroit, a pilot came to the gate. His plane wasn't there. Instead of waiting for someone to bring it, he got in a pickup truck and he went over to the hangar and got his plane and brought it back to the gate. So it's kind of lifting all of these, I guess you'd call them work rules that are in the contracts. And it is the same kind of an issue that the Detroit automakers face in relation to the non-union foreign automakers in the United States.
Well, Professor Gregory, jump in on this, because it's sounding as if this has to do then with the particular union in this case. In the Northwest case, it's the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association, or AMFA, and it sounds as if the personality of the union has a lot to do with this. We're noticing, for instance, that other unions didn't join the strike. So explain more about how that has impacted here.
Well, we have one particular small union that's taken probably the worst possible move at the worst possible time for the union's interests. But the broader point, and this really goes to Mickey's terrific reporting and her great book, the broader point is the theme of globalization. And within that, outsourcing, subcontracting of work to minimize labor costs. That is the fundamental theme now, I think, operating in the airline and auto industries and in many others. But those are the two now most prominent.
So how would this affect the auto industry, Professor?
Well, I think we've seen the rise of the Japanese and German auto manufacturers in the United States. None of their facilities are unionized. And at the same time, we have effectively the near collapse of General Motors and of Ford Motor Company. So it's sort of the creative destruction of capitalism, and we're seeing lots of opportunities to turn out a superior product and make a lot of profit and pay good wages in a non-unionized model. And that's gone global now.
But at the same time, cutting benefits, as we're hearing. Mickey, how is, for instance, General Motors watching this?
General Motors, the union at General Motors, the UAW, is actually holding a big meeting in Chicago this week. General Motors has asked the union to consider cutting back on some of their very generous health care costs. General Motors and Ford have something called legacy costs, which are the pensions and the health care that they provide not only to their workers but to their workers' families. And that average is something like $1,400 a car. And General Motors believes that just the health care bill alone is what's keeping it from becoming competitive. So they've asked the union to consider reducing some of their health care benefits. And it's a really tough fight for the UAW because over the years they've never given back anything that they've bargained for. And this would be a seminal moment for them if they decide to do so.
Yeah, Mickey, I want to ask you though. I mean, some listening to this might say, well, this might be great if it gives me a lower car price or
lower cost car.
Or lower cost airfare. But in the long run, do we want our repairing of our airplanes to be outsourced? Is that really what Americans are going to want in the long run? And how is this going to impact everybody else's pension and benefits?
Well, I think, as Tom said, what Americans want when it comes to the airlines is the cheapest possible ticket. And whether a union member repairs it or a non-union member repairs it, they don't really care. Now, of course, there are people who care. I'm a union member myself. I'm a member of the Newspaper Guild. You know, for example, there's a strike at the CBC, and we've all been asked not to appear on CBC shows,
Canadian broadcasting.
To do. Excuse me. Yeah. So in that case, you know, some people care, but the vast majority don't. And I, frankly, am really surprised that not only has Northwest had, I mean, they've had delays and some cancellations, but the planes are not flying half full. The planes are flying full. Mm. People are not turning in their tickets. People are not canceling future reservations. The passengers, for the most part, are going right ahead with their plans. That, to me, says that maybe Northwest outthought the union, at least in that respect.
And even the other unions, as we said, are not joining. But David, in the last minute that we have, what's the message for big labor? More militant or more compliant?
I think in the short term, potentially more militant, since we've seen the splintering now at the AFL-CIO, and I think we're going to see more aggressive, more militant bargaining, at least in the short term.
Well, that's David Gregory. He's a professor of labor law at St. John's University in New York City. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mickey Maynard also spoke with us. She's a reporter with the New York Times. She covers the airline industry. We'll check back with both of you as this strike goes along to see how it unfolds. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, New York politics. Can a former Massachusetts governor make it in New York? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Taliban leaders are saying they won't attack polling stations when parliamentary elections take place in Afghanistan next month, despite a surge in violence that has made this year the deadliest in Afghanistan since the war began in 2001. 4 Americans died this weekend during a bold attack on an embassy convoy near Kabul as insurgents pour into the country, including an al-Qaeda unit reported to have returned to Afghanistan to teach a new tactic learned in Iraq. Carlotta Gall covers Afghanistan for the New York Times. She joins us on the line from Kabul. And Carlotta, that intriguing line jumped out at us from your article today. Tell us more about this al-Qaeda unit bringing back a new tactic.
Well, we don't know much more than that, except that the Taliban have been boasting of having a new weapon. And sometimes they've said it's an anti-aircraft missile. The excitement rose up really last month when the Navy SEAL helicopter was shot down in the eastern part of the country, and there was some speculation it was an anti-aircraft missile. We now think it was an RPG, which is a much more common weapon. But the Taliban have continued to suggest that they have some special weapon. In other ways, they suggest they have some special tactic. And so possibly, I think people are bracing themselves for something newer or more sophisticated.
Well, they may have a new weapon, but as we said, a Taliban spokesperson has said that the Taliban will not attack polling stations in next month's elections so as not to kill civilians. Is this promise to be taken seriously?
He's someone who frequently speaks for the Taliban, and sometimes he says things which turn out to be true or fairly accurate. Other times he's made preposterous claims which are clearly untrue. For example, they claim to be holding one of the Navy SEALs that went missing in fighting last month. But I think this may be true in that we saw in the last presidential election a surprising layoff of violent actions around polling day. But he did stress in the same conversation that he would continue to attack Afghan and American forces.
Well, while the death toll for American soldiers in Afghanistan is still relatively low, and I say that relative to Iraq, the death toll in Afghanistan is at 181 since 2001. But as you note, it's increasing. What are other concerns about the increased violence and the death toll?
Recently, the last 2 months, we've seen a sharp increase. You know, it's one a day even, or a couple today, then, you know, another couple of days, and then there's 4 people killed. So it's incremental, but it is a lot higher than previous months. Also, the fact that they're doing more and more roadside bombs, and the last one killed 4 soldiers. In other words, it was a very big explosion. So I think there's concern that they're doing more of that, they're getting more sophisticated, and they're more organized about these attacks.
And you write that they're in more surprising areas, near Kabul, for instance.
Yes, that was a big surprise. We haven't had anything on the west side of Kabul and anything on an embassy patrol, so that was, or sort of, you know, convoy. So that was a surprise.
Well, Khalid Agal, you also write that Afghani officials are accusing Pakistan of supporting a long-term strategy of destabilization in Afghanistan, you know, in order to keep the country weak, that these insurgents are coming in not just from Iraq, but from Pakistan, perhaps with Pakistan's blessing.
It's very clear that they're coming over the border. They can't catch them all because the mountain passes are so remote and the border is so long. But there's no doubt they have a sanctuary in Pakistan. And finally this year, the Afghan government, which has bent over backwards, I think, for the last few years to promote good relations with their neighbor, Pakistan, has finally lost patience. And now they're speaking out more and more and complaining right up to the president. President Karzai is talking about it. And they're very frustrated because I think they think that this could be a very long-term, as one official said, undeclared war that Afghanistan could face for many years. And I think that's deeply worrying to the Afghan government.
Well, Carlotta, we usually speak to you about the increase in violence, the attacks, the upcoming election. But you've also written wonderful feature stories, one recently about a nomadic woman running for office. Can you just paint a picture for us? What is the scene in Afghanistan? Are girls going to school? Is there a cultural life there? How is the country faring outside of this violence, or is it just frozen in anticipation of the election?
Well, no. I mean, the nice thing is that the elections are undoubtedly going ahead, and there's a lot of work going on, and there are a lot of candidates going around and campaigning. There's some areas that are violent, and it's very, very difficult, especially for women candidates, to move around freely. But certainly in the cities, there's enormous activity. You go to the park in Kabul, and it's crammed with young people playing football or hanging out or just chatting with friends. There's rallies already going on in the center, and there's enormous commercial business happening. Small shops, small businesses, but very busy. But in the countryside, obviously, it's a bit different. It's still very poor, and agriculture is struggling, and there is some insecurity in places. But I think what you feel wherever you go in Afghanistan is a huge hive of activity, of energy to now let's get on and rebuild our lives. So you feel that everywhere, and you also feel a huge enthusiasm among young people to stroll around and meet and chat, and then they're all going to internet classes and English classes. So there's a great sense of activity everywhere you go, I think.
Carlotta Gall covers Afghanistan for the New York Times. She's speaking to us from Kabul. Carlotta, thanks as always.
Okay, thank you.
And now this brief note regarding Venezuela. Conservative Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson is calling for the United States to assassinate Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. On his television program, The 700 Club, yesterday, Robertson called Chavez a dangerous neighbor bent on exporting Muslim extremism and communism across the Americas.
We don't need another $200 billion war to get rid of one, you know, strong-armed dictator. It's a whole lot easier to have some of the covert operatives do the job and then get it over with.
Well, this is not the first time Robertson has made headlines with his remarks. Earlier this year, he said that activist judges might be more of a threat to the U.S. than a few bearded terrorists who fly into buildings. While Robertson's words might be considered extreme, Washington's made no secret of its dislike for Chavez. Chavez has accused the U.S. of trying to assassinate him and topple his government. The Bush administration has dismissed these statements in the past. Chavez met with Fidel Castro in Cuba this past weekend. He's in Jamaica today to finalize a plan to provide cheaper oil to Caribbean countries. And still to come, singer and musician Raul Midon. Ever heard of a mouth trumpet? He plays one. You're listening to Here and Now. He describes Bill Clinton as the oddest of seven presidents he's known, prone to making late-night rambling phone calls. He accuses Bob Dole of stealing his jokes. He's former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, and his new memoir, Herding Cats, A Life in Politics, comes out today. In it, Lott also takes the unusual step of fingering a number of fellow Republicans, accusing Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of betrayal. Lott also expresses little remorse for praising the 1948 presidential candidacy of then-segregationist Strom Thurmond. Comments made at Thurmond's 100th birthday party led to Lott's fall from power nearly 3 years ago. Well, joining us on the line is Anna Radelot. She's a Washington correspondent for Gannett News Service. Anna, is Lott's memoir a good read?
It's very readable. It's very Trent Lott. He's very plain-spoken and candid.
Well, let's find out why he wrote it, do you think? And was it just to take a pot shot at Bill Frist, who took over when Lott resigned? I mean, what does he say about Bill Frist? Let's start there.
Well, he says that Bill Frist didn't have the courtesy of telling him that he was going after the job, that he had taken Bill Frist under his wing, and that as a freshman, Lott showed him the ropes, introduced him to the president, and that he was betrayed by Frist, what he calls a power grab by Frist.
Trent Lott is also pretty blunt about President Bush at that time. He writes about what the president said to him after Lott resigned and what Lott said back. Can you paraphrase for us?
Well, he does call Bush the most likable of all the presidents he's met. At the same time, he received a call from Bush a few days after his resignation, and in that call, he told the president, "You know, you really didn't help me."
So your sense of the book, is it just to settle scores?
One of the ghostwriters who was not hired said that he got the impression early on that Lott was looking to write a payback book.
In fact, he writes a lot about politics as he viewed them in less polarized times. He describes working with Democrats such as President Clinton and what he calls a backstairs relationship, these late-night phone calls. Also, then-Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, he would meet with. In fact, he writes he even had a secret phone line put in Daschle's office. What do you read that says about Trent Lott's style?
Well, Lott says it himself. He says, you know, I'm a conservative, but I'm a pragmatist. And that's Trent Lott. If you have to, you know, talk to Daschle and forge a compromise with Daschle or forge a compromise with Clinton on a balanced budget, that's what you do. And mm-hmm. and he, I think anybody would say that you know, that's a marked different style mm-hmm. from Senator Frist.
You write also that Trent Lott in the book reveals little remorse over his racial attitudes. He admits to feeling angry about the forced integration of his alma mater, that's Ole Miss, in 1962, anger at what he perceived as his liberal professors that he says created conservatives, and even blames former Senator Bob Dole for Trent Lott's disastrous remarks at Strom Thurmond's birthday party. He says Dole stole his jokes so he didn't have any left.
Yes, he tries, I guess, in the book to deal with the issue of race, and I don't know if he's successful in doing that. He calls his remarks thoughtless and innocent. Like, they were off the cuff. But
and you write as a Washington correspondent, you have said that Trent Lott is a complicated person.
And I think that's what makes him interesting. I think any other politician, your average politician who had gone through a scandal like he did and had such a precipitous fall, such a quick precipitous fall, couldn't survive. But Lott, you know, I've written that he's had a second act, you know, and he's doing quite well.
Well, what do you think is going to happen now, Anna Radelot? Do you think this is going to be a part of a political comeback for him, or is this going to be damaging?
That's a very good question, and I can't really say. Some people have speculated that he may not run again next year. I don't think so. I think, you know, the damage was already done. You know, I don't think he cares. I think he will stay in the Senate. I think he can still be effective in the Senate, even with this book, which is not going to make a lot of people in the Republican ranks happy.
Anna Radelot, Washington correspondent for Gannett News Service, with sort of a book report on former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott's new memoir. It's called Herding Cats, A Life in Politics. Anna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Some terrific music ahead here and now.
something about going to heaven. Grab a little bit of heaven right here on earth. Troubled times lead to healing times. I was sad, now I'm feeling fine. It's a taking and a giving that makes this life worth living. Makes this life worth living. I want to be rich. I want to be happy. And live inside a love that shines bright enough to last a lifetime. I want to be rich.
Raoul Midon is a soul singer in every sense. His smooth voice brings to mind some of the greatest ever, artists like Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and Donny Hathaway. Add to that a strong rhythmic sensibility and flamenco-inspired guitar, and you have a modern musician crossing over musical terrain on a path paved with jazz, R&B, and a little reggae. Raoul Midon's debut CD, State of Mind, is out now on Manhattan Records. It features his signature sound, the mouth trumpet, as Here Now's Frank Stacio discovered.
You are a singer and a musician, and you wrote the songs in your CD, mostly solo guitar, and a voice that you call a mouth trumpet.
Yeah, that's kind of my admiration for jazz trumpet players, and it kind of turned into a thing that I do. I really got interested in, just was listening to a lot of Miles and Clifford Brown, and I was doing a lot of, you know, sort of transcribing of solos, and so I got into, you know, trying to make that sound with my voice.
Were you interested in jazz early on as a really, you know, young man?
Well, not the my first interests were flamenco and Argentine folkloric music, to some extent pop music, but not really. I was more interested in those kinds of things, and kind of came to jazz when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I heard a Charlie Parker record, and I said to my dad, what's that?
And your dad's Argentinian?
Yes.
Right? Now, you've been blind since you were a baby.
Yes.
How has that shaped your craft, do you think?
You know, it's hard for me to say because I've always been blind. Perhaps it may have given me a little more focus. Maybe since I had fewer options, that maybe being blind put it into focus a little bit more. And music was always something I was interested in, and I was encouraged to do it from a young age.
Your father encouraged you both?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I got my first lessons when I was 6 years old. Wow. So.
Raoul, you mostly do solo work. I wonder how you feel about collaborating. You like to work with other artists?
I love collaborating. I mean, there are some collaborations on this record as well.
Well, and Stevie Wonder is one of those collaborations.
Yes.
You got him playing harmonica on this thing.
Yeah.
And you, in a sense, collaborated with Arif Mardin, who produced the CD.
Absolutely.
He's worked with some of the best-known jazz and soul people in the business. Aretha Franklin, right? And Donny Hathaway.
Giving up is hard to do. When you really love someone, giving up.
That's Donny Hathaway, one of the inspirations for my guest this hour, Raoul Midon, whose debut CD, State of Mind, is out now on Manhattan Records. Raoul is my guest. Raoul, what is it about Donny Hathaway that inspired you?
Well, it's just one of the dreams that I had was to work with someone that has the sort of background that I have, the jazz background, somebody that's very steeped in all kinds of music, soul music as well as jazz. And Arif Mardin is, you know, the perfect producer. So I use Donny as kind of an inspiration for me to come to the studio every day and just give the best that I could.
Let's listen to a little of Sitting in the Middle, Raoul. That's your song, the song you wrote and dedicated to Donny Hathaway.
Yes.
So much to me, a chance to find my destiny. Feeling is believing, and I'm feeling fine. Fine, despite the things I know, there is no place I'd rather go or be. Here is my destiny, and now's the time for sitting in the middle of the ones I love. Nothing else matters.
sitting in the middle of the ones I love. Surrounded by the light, sitting in the middle of the ones I love. Nothing can shatter, sitting in the middle of the ones I love. Surrounded by these city streets so full of noise where people walk.
There are certainly a lot of elements that run through your music. There's a sort of Afro-Cuban, we can hear that, jazz, mm-hmm. obviously. But the, for me, the overwhelming sensibility is something we used to call soul.
Absolutely.
Soul singing, and it's a real genre in a form. And I've always felt that it's a very tightly defined form, and you bring a real artistry and authenticity to it. What's the trick in bringing to a form that everybody has a lot of expectations about? We know what this sounds like, and somehow you have to bring something new to it.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, and I love that you say that, because people hear somebody sing with the soul aesthetic and they think, oh, you're imitating Stevie Wonder, mm-hmm. you know. And it's not. There's as you said, there's a whole sort of tradition of soul singing. And that's, you know, the trick for me is there's no trick. I mean, I just try to put the things that I love into the music that I do. So whatever it is, I never thought of myself as a jazz player or a soul singer or a folk singer, or I just kind of put the things that I love into the music.
Are you the one? Are you one of the ones who's going to be in the vanguard of the crossover movement?
I don't know. I just want to bring good music into the mainstream. And no matter what happens, I want to be myself and do things in the best way that I can. And, you know, somebody that can actually play and sing and actually do what they're supposed to be doing. So, you know, I want to be one of those.
All right. Will you play something for us?
Sure. Speaking of genre-less or things that incorporate a lot of things, I'm going to play this song. It's the collaboration I did with Louis Vega. And Louis is a dance DJ, you know. So this kind of has all kinds of stuff in it. It's I call it a gumbo, a musical gumbo.
It's Raul Madone. Thank you very much for joining us here and now.
Thank you for having me.
Ven acá. Ae, ae, ae la chambelona, ae, ae, ae la chambelona, ae, ae, ae la chambelona.
That's Raul Madone. He spoke with Here Now's Frank Stacio. You can find out more about Raul Madone. And by the way, you can find out what's on his CD player, who's he listening to right now, by going to our website, here-now.org.
Sunshine, when you're with me, I can fly. Sunshine, when you're with me, I can fly.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Tara Murphy, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Noah Susskind and Kate Goldring on her last day with us today. Oh, who will get us out of hot water? In fact, who will get me my hot water? Kate, thank you. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Even when I'm far away, makes no difference what they say, as long as you will be my sunshine. When you're with me, I can fly.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com. And by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
I'm Robin Young.